Okay, so this is the seminar that's based on my dissertation. I have zero interest in like working through my dissertation. I think that'd be very tedious for all of us, including myself. I'm obviously going to use the materials that I studied, but this is a different thing in this kind of setting. And this is my first time taking this paper and translating it into a class setting. So it's going to be interesting, and I'll appreciate your feedback on it. And also, if you haven't taken a class with me before, I love to interact. So if you have questions and comments, and let's get into it. This, just to give you a little bit of background, tonight we're going to do mostly kind of background overview framework to help you understand what this is about, what the seminar will be about, and we'll get into a few specific materials. But I want to note two questions at the outset. I want to get these questions into your mind. We're not necessarily going to get into answers to these questions too much tonight, but I want you to think about these questions. And the first question is the question of definition, which is, what is abuse? There's a number of large words like that are used very often. We all use them. But when it comes to define it, there's a real challenge there. And abuse is, I used the phrase, a powerful word. And there's a few plays on words in that. But it's a very powerful word. If someone says they've been abused, thankfully, that still has some potency in our society. It's an important word. And so it's important that we understand what the word means, because it's also a word that's being used for agendas. And so there can be dangers. And right now, we know culturally, there's a massive project of redefining words, right? And so whoever defines a word has tremendous control over how a problem's understood and what prescriptions are offered, right? So a slogan like "No person is illegal," right? With what's going on right now with our southern border, right? Are persons illegal? How do we think about, are they migrants? Are they aliens? Are they illegal aliens? Are they foreign? Like what is that? Defining that gets to the problem, right? And then it also constrains the solutions that you can provide based on the definition. So to think about, what is abuse? The other thing you want to think about is, what does the Lord require of you when you receive an accusation of abuse? Right? Whether it's an accusation against you or against someone else. So someone comes to you and says, I've been abused. What's a righteous response in that moment? I would guess that some of us have heard that phrase, especially as kind of species of abuse have multiplied. So abuse used to be more physical, sexual, child abuse, and now it's psychological, it's emotional, it's verbal, it's spiritual. Right? That's kind of the latest hottest topic, is spiritual abuse. Someone comes to you and says, I've been spiritually abused, I've been verbally abused. How do you respond in that moment? How should you respond in that moment? What biblical categories and truths do you need to know how to respond in that moment? Okay, so those two questions are basically the subtitle on defining and responding justly to abuse. Those were the questions that were in my mind. And so why this topic and why now? Well, it's a huge topic. I put the word ubiquity there. It just means it's everywhere. Right? It was the Roman Catholics, that was the first kind of huge explosion. They're a huge church. They had a huge problem. There's a lot that goes into that, but there was the scandal of clergy sexual abuse, especially minors. Right? Ravi Zacharias, Southern Baptist Convention, Sovereign Grace, James McDonald, Mark Driscoll, Acts 29, Matt Chandler, right? Go on and on and on. And those are just church, Then you go more broadly, the whole Me Too movement, Hollywood, Wall Street, politicians. This is a huge issue, and it's everywhere. It's everywhere. So it's a very important issue. So the ubiquity that it's everywhere, that's one reason. The other is that it is actually important. It's a very important issue for a lot of reasons. It's important for us to understand what is and is not abuse. It's important for us to understand how to care for people who've been abused or are alleging abuse. It's important for us to understand how to resist when you're falsely accused of abuse. Right? Because classic Christian ethics are, by definition, abusive in our culture. If you think men and women are different, that's abuse. If you think that gender is defined defined by God and established at conception, that's abuse. If you think so, things that Christians have always believed are considered abusive. And if you hold fast to those things, there's a pretty decent chance you're going to be labeled some species of abuse. There's other synonyms for it, right? It's oppressive, it's tyrannical, it's whatever. So it's important for us to think biblically so that we can engage things properly. And so when I started my studies, the way it works, at least in America, is you take some seminars before you do your exams, your dissertation. And if you can have your project in view, that's the best way to do it, because then you can write papers as you go that lead towards your dissertation. And so 4.5 years ago, I'm looking at, okay, what would be a project that would be an important issue that I think needs some important correctives biblically and would serve the church, right? And so that's what got me thinking about covering this topic, because it's an important topic that I'm concerned that the church is mishandling, but not in the way that society's talking about it. If you're familiar with the Southern Baptist Convention and their response to abuse, it's becoming evident that they were played big time with this issue. And they're already pouring millions of dollars, almost in penance. And if they don't make some key corrections, they could be financially ruined in an effort to show, yes, we care about abuse. No, we don't want to cover up abuse, right? So let's address this in a way that shows everybody that. But yet, there is actually no evidence that they did cover up abuse. But that's been the allegation for years, right? And so we need to think about this biblically so we can respond righteously. So what's at stake? Well, genuine care for victims. If you're going to care for a victim of abuse, you need to understand what it is, right? To genuinely care for someone. And also that we would honor the Lord and his word in how we walk. So so as attention has surged, as this has gotten everybody's notice, what's been positive about that? Well, it's heightened. It's made us aware of a very real problem, right? Abuse is a very real problem. It's not a small problem. It's not exactly rare. You look at church history. You look at human history, and there's a lot of abuse, a lot of abuse. And especially when you consider abuse broadly, where it's not just interpersonal, but it's also things like governmental tyranny. That's abuse, right? It's all of the same species. And so to bring attention to a real, enduring human problem is helpful. I think that it has led to people, especially within the church, taking steps to protect susceptible persons. And so one of the things we're going to talk about is that if you have authority and responsibility in life, which we all do in various capacities, the Lord has given you a duty of protection. You are required by God to protect the people entrusted to you in ways appropriate to your various relationships, and especially to protect those who are susceptible, or oftentimes the word vulnerable is used. And so you think about Scripture where it talks about the orphan, the widow, right, the oppressed, and it's especially the king's responsibility to do that. The nature of abuse is such that the only way you can be abused is if someone has an advantage over you in some way, right? So if an adult man fights a five-year-old, you know, that's abuse. The size, the maturity, the strength, like, that's abuse. He can't. Two men fight, that's boxing, right? That's not abusive. But a man beating on a boy, that's abuse because of the disparity in size and strength. And the way that the abuse world talks about that dynamic is they say those disparities are basically abusive. The existence of any disparity is abusive, right? The problem is God designed a world filled with disparities. He built a hierarchical world. He built a world where we're not all equal, right? Which is very un-American, very undemocratic. It just happens to be true. And you, part of what I think you're going to see, Lord willing, in the weeks ahead, is that the values and the themes that are running through the abuse issue are part of this broader society-wide issue. So with DEI, for example, the presence, the diversity, equity, inclusion, the presence of any disparity, any inequality is seen as de facto, like by definition, abuse. It's unfair, right? That's how, so financial levels, education levels, like if there's any differences between skin color, gender, geographical location, those things are considered abusive and oppressive by definition and must be eradicated, right? And those who are in the position of doing better are privileged and must be brought down, and those who are in the position of doing worse are oppressed and must be elevated. And of course, the ones to fix that are the government, because then they alone have the power and the wisdom to step back and see it all and make it all right, right? Like that's the system. There's a very similar view in relation to abuse, right? There's values. These values are playing out broadly in our society. There is a biblical duty to protect those who are vulnerable, those who are susceptible, right? Especially in relation to our God-given responsibilities. And that's an important theme, too. So I don't have an obligation to every child in the world. I have a high obligation to my children. I have some obligation to the children in my neighborhood. I think I have more obligation to the children of this church, right? Like that's the way these things work. The Lord gives us responsibilities, and then we have duties in those, and those responsibilities come with authority. Okay. And we'll talk about that. So, but that has been good to increase people's awareness of, hey, there are susceptible persons in the world, and we have a duty towards them. It's also been good to bring more attention and resources for victims, right? People are being abused, and if we can care for them, if we can help them, if we can point them to the comfort and grace of God, right? Abuse doesn't define, there's a whole discussion about, do you call someone a victim or a survivor of abuse, right? And they're both getting at various elements there. And I think both of those terms can be helpful. I also think ultimately there, if that becomes your identity, that's unhelpful. You're neither of those things, right? You're a child of God. That's who you are. And yes, you might have been victimized in a certain way, but that doesn't define you. So that's some of what's been good. What concerns should we have about current approaches? Well, I put the Latin phrase there, sui generis or sui generis. You see that phrase used in relation to God, that God is unique. He's of his own kind. He's one of a kind, right? It seems to me that abuse is treated as of its own kind. There's no other sin. There's no other problem like abuse. Abuse is just so uniquely sinful that all other, you know, considerations and biblical understandings just kind of go out the window because this problem is so great and it's so unique. I think that's a problem, right? Abuse is not unique. It's part of a broader pattern of sin, and other biblical categories of sin help us to understand abuse so that we're not treating it as something that is independent. You'll often see this, especially discouragingly, in Christian books dealing with abuse, is they tend to at least diminish, if not dismiss altogether, biblical categories because they say, you don't understand, right? It doesn't apply to this. So, I'll get to that in a minute. I think related to that is the idea of what I've labeled here the expert trap. And so it's if you aren't trauma-informed, if you're not an expert in various ways, you don't know how to handle it, right? And it's an interesting thing because our society has largely embraced this idea of experts, right? These experts who know. Now, I think we've lost some of that with COVID and other things where people are like, well, maybe the experts aren't so expert. But there was tremendous value placed on experts with especially through the 20th century. And there's a reason that therapeutic psychology, you know, Freud said, look, I want to have an alternative to the church. I want to have an alternative priesthood that describes human problems and brings solutions that's different from the church. That's where psychology started. But as they saw, you know what, the people who have standing in our society are the scientists. They're the experts. Then they started to position themselves as that. We're a hard science. Psychology is a hard science. We've got these guilds. We've got these credentials. We're the experts, right? And this veneer of objectivity. And that has played out in abuse issues as well, where it's, look, there's just this special knowledge that if you don't have it, you can't speak to this at all. And most often when you read even Christian books on abuse, what they say is, look, the best thing the church can do is look to care, provide some basic, you know, money and goods, and then get out of the way and let the experts address these situations, right? And what we don't want to do is say, yeah, experts, they're idiots. No. If somebody's studied an issue deeply, like, let's benefit from that. Let's appreciate that. But let's not pretend that this is an issue that Scripture doesn't speak to and that God hasn't called his church to engage with, right? And that the categories of biblical justice and fellowship and all kinds of things don't apply to, because they do. And so I want to push back. I think it was someone else may know. Was it William F. Buckley who said, I'd rather be governed by the first 50 names in the Boston phone book than the faculty of Harvard? like there's a reality to that, right? And maybe it's, you know, my dad's a carpenter. I just grew up kind of blue collar. I tend to trust people who get their hands dirty sometimes more because there's, you know, like, so for farming, you can have all kinds of highfalutin theories, but at the end of the day, if you don't understand how soil works and how rain works and how sun works, you're not going to get a crop and you're going to die. Right? Like, there's just, this is reality. If you confuse genders and farming, your herd's going to die, right? Like, it's just, there's just this reality that pushes against all these theories, right? So, yes, we want to, there are certainly things to be learned from people who've studied abuse deeply. We also want to appreciate, we also want to be able to critique. Okay, there's certain values, there's certain commitments here that are steering how you understand it and how you respond to it, right? That aren't just, well, this is what reality is. It's no, you've got some commitments here that are blinding you to certain things and driving you to other things that can be quite dangerous. Okay? And we'll get into that. One of the big things, too, is this redefinition of justice. And, of course, that's not just for abuse. That's for society in general. Our society is deeply, deeply messed up when it comes to justice. And critical theory, indeed, you know, that all of that has distorted significantly how the Bible talks about justice. To the point where, like I said, if you're in a privileged position, you are presumed guilty until you can demonstrate that you're innocent or at least an ally to the oppressed. That's not biblical, right? So if you hear an allegation against someone and your framework is, well, it's a man against a woman, or it's this skin tone against that skin tone, or it's the rich person against the poor person, or it's, right? And that tells me who's guilty. You're being biased and unbiblical. Right? It's one thing to recognize, you know what, there are certain disparities in the world, and generally it is the rich who oppress the poor, and generally it is men who oppress women, and generally, right, the strong oppress the weak, and because it's easier. Generally, you know, what group abuses children the most? Parents in the 25 to 40-year-old range. Why? They have the most access to children. Right? It's not surprising. So, but are parents then to be presumed guilty because they're in this range? No. Right? And so trying to think through, so here's a question for you. Going back to the, it was interesting I wrote my dissertation, and you have what they call the oral defense. And so I'm sitting there with my committee. And it seemed like there was one person in particular who did not seem to have a category of, I should evaluate an allegation of abuse on whether or not it's proper for me to be involved in this situation. Right? It was just, well, here's an allegation, and I care about people, so I'm going to go toward them to care about them. Is that a biblical position? Are you authorized by God? We're going to talk about this in, I think it's week four, week five, Lord willing. We talk about justice. If we understand accusations biblically, as we understand accusations biblically, we all ought to be deeply uncomfortable. Because we receive accusations against other people all the time. And we tend not to even think about it biblically. So, social media, like if you couldn't have unsubstantiated accusations, there would hardly be any social media. Right? That's so much of what social media is. Tabloids. Right? This celebrity, did you hear about this celebrity who did? Yeah, Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift and blah, 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 right? I bet most of us think we know something about Travis Kelce and Taylor Swift. Do you really? Like, how would you know that? Because you heard gossip from somebody and probably slander and, right? Like, just so much. And so somebody comes and makes an accusation against somebody else. And we just, oh, I'm so sorry. Well, is it true? Do you know that accusation's true? Has God authorized you to engage in that situation? That's actually a huge issue for biblical justice. And how do we think about this? Okay? So that, and then slogans like, believe all victims. You know, at first I think it was believe all women. But then it moved to believe all victims. And the problem with that, there's a couple problems. One is it's a truism. So if somebody's a victim, there's nothing to believe anymore. Like, they're a victim. That's been established. I know they're a victim. It's not a matter of belief. It's just, it's true. And so you care for them. But that's not what they're saying, right? What they're saying is believe all accusers. Well, you don't say that because that doesn't sound good. And people know, actually, there are some false accusations, so maybe that wouldn't be a good idea, right? So believe all victims is the most attractive label you could give to it. It's just not biblical, right? And we need to think about, how does the Bible apply to this, right? Now, and we also, and we'll get into this, but we do need to have a category of someone can be abused. So they're a victim, and God knows, and they know, and the abuser knows, but we don't know. And we follow biblical processes of justice, and we still don't know. Does that happen? And what do we do with that? Right? How should we think about that? So they could be a victim from God's perspective that we don't know and we can't establish. Right? And it would be wrong for us to label them as a victim, not being able to know and establish it. Okay? Doesn't mean we disbelieve them or disregard them or any of that, but it means it's wrong to receive an accusation, believe it, and act upon it without engaging the issue of, is this true and am I authorized to do something about this? Okay, those are important questions that just are not on anybody's radar out there, which is part of how you get into a lot of, you know, think about, I never know how you pronounce that guy's name. Is it Juicy or Smollett, right? The guy who made the accusation, this is MAGA country, and he was beat up, and it was all lies, right? And yet, as soon as he made the accusations, all these people are on social media, oh, this is terrible, I can't believe, and right? And then it comes out that he was lying, and he hired people to do this, and nobody walks it back. Nobody says, oh, man, I was way out of line. I should have never. Right? And that's constant, too. And social media is just perpetual short-term outrage. So we need to do better as Christians. That's, outrage is part of the paradigm. You know, it's part of the algorithm for social media. But so that, and then hurt people, that's another one too, where there's truth to it, right? Where you're sinned against. You're a person who's been hurt, and you sin in return. Hurt people, right? And so where that can be helpful is to understand, yeah, okay, when somebody's been wronged, oftentimes they would sin in response. But where it gets to be problematic is where it's then, therefore, they're not responsible because they were hurt. They were sinned against, right? So, you know, with the riots and looting after George Floyd, it was, this is the voice of the unheard, the voice of the oppressed. It's not wrong. Can't say it's wrong. Right? Vodi Bakum has a great phrase for that. He calls it ethnic antinomianism. Right? If your ethnicity is one that's considered oppressed, then you can do no wrong. That applies to all kinds of minority classes. Women, right? The poor, that, like, just depending on your, profoundly unbiblical. Being sinned against by another never justifies sin in response. Right? But that's often how that phrase is used. Now, if someone has been victimized, and they're sinning in some way in their response, our first response is not to, oh, hey, that attitude's not okay. Right? Someone's genuinely been victimized. You care for them. You offer them the comfort of the Lord. You're slow to correct. Right? We don't start with, hey, you have to have a perfect response to what happened to you. But we also don't actually love and dignify people if we don't treat them as responsible agents before the Lord. We don't ultimately offer them faith and love and the ability to glorify God when we say, you know what, go do whatever you want because you've been wrong so badly. Right, that's not actually caring for someone. It can seem caring, but it's not. So slogans like that can be very unhelpful. And another factor, I think, that it does seem to me that there can be an almost utopian idea that if we just handle it in this way, there'll be no more abuse, right? If we just set up the perfect safeguards and the background checks and the structures and the, right, and we just will basically eradicate abuse. And that's just not going to happen, right? It's one of the really hard, because abuse is tragic. It's heinous, right? The Lord hates it. And it's going to occur until Jesus returns. Now, it doesn't mean that it's all at the same level. And one of the things, if you look at Christianity, where Christianity has spread and where God's word has been proclaimed and believed, things like abuse go way down, right? So it can certainly be diminished. But it's not going to be eradicated, this side of eternity. And so we need to think biblically about that, because there can be, I think, in our culture, an unhelpful focus on safety, where safety is seen as the ultimate value. We have to be safe. And safety can't possibly bear that weight. It just can't. It's neither possible nor desirable to live in that kind of world. Right? We need to take risks. Now, we need to be wise. But we need to take risks. It's a risk. Like, you got in your car and drove here. That's risky. Right? You've done all kinds of, like, people die of everything. Right? I'm sure somebody's died from clicking their pen, or the most mundane things. People die from all the time. Like, it's a risky world. And it's important for us to, as Christians, to be able to navigate that risk and to recognize it and say, and there are some masculine feminine dynamics in that, right? I don't think it's coincidence that our society has gone, full bore after feminism and has also really emphasized safety. And there's a need for men to stand up and say, no, there's more to life than this, right? And to raise our sons to say, hey, I'm going to take some risks. Yeah, son, go jump off that cliff into the water. Like, do it, you know? And yeah, you might get hurt. Rub some dirt on it and do it again, right? Like that. We need, the Lord is our refuge. There's safety in him. But the safety that we have in the Lord is not the absence of risk, and it's not the absence of pain or problems. So we need to think about that. Like, we need to take wise steps to protect those the Lord entrusts to us. We need to think biblically about abuse. But if we think that if we're going to say, okay, we're going to make sure that there could never be abuse in our church. I mean, I guess we could buy, like, enormous rolls of bubble wrap and, like, wrap everybody up as they come in the door and, like, you know, just, but it'd be ridiculous, right? It's just not the way we're meant to engage in God's world. So we need to think biblically about safety too, and about the potential for addressing abuse but not eliminating it. So what the seminar is not, this is not a training on how to care and counsel for those who are abused. There will be elements of that, but that's not the focus, okay? I think understanding what we talk about will help you to do much better in caring and counseling. But that's not what the focus is. So that's the introduction. Any questions on that? Okay, so overview, we have up to 6 weeks. I really don't know how long it's going to take, so it won't be more than that, but it could potentially be less. We'll see. So this week we're going to do what we just did, the introduction, and get into definition of history a little bit. Next week, Lord willing, we're going to talk about power and control. Those are the terms that are everywhere, and you're going to see that a little bit tonight. They're everywhere in discussions about abuse, right? And so how should we think about, as Christians, how should we think about power and control? One of the interesting ways that's playing out right now is with the election. And there's all these books out blasting Christians for how could you vote for Donald Trump? You're so compromised. All you care about is power. Okay, well, is that bad? Is it bad to care about power? Is it bad to actually seek to gain power? Is it bad to seek to impose your morality on others? Right? Those are political, but they go beyond that. I hope you impose your morality on your children. That's called parenting, right? Like, so how should we think about these things? Is it abusive? Is it abusive? So, I mean, I grew up, you know, you can't legislate morality. You can't, right? And you understand, you grow up with these slogans, and then you realize, that doesn't make any sense. That's all legislation is morality. It's not whether or not somebody's going to legislate morality, it's whose morality, right? Which relates to how you think about power and control. And what's the role of the church in society? And what's the role of the individual Christian, right? So that'll be week two. And we're going to talk about power over, power under. I don't know if you've heard that phrase, but it has kind of gained ascendancy. And a lot of people talk about how Jesus never exercised power over. It was always only power under, right? Which sounds very pious. It's just not true. But that's how it's presented, and that's presented in the abuse discussion. And so we're going to look at power and control biblically. How do those themes unfold throughout Scripture? And then we're going to answer the question, did David rape Bathsheba, right? That's because that's the power and control. Like, that's the driving issue in how people talk about that. Week three, Lord willing, we're going to do the Duluth model. I lived near Duluth. I had friends from Duluth. Duluth is like way upper Minnesota. If you ever watch the movie Fargo, they talk like Duluth. You know, they're funny. They're stuck up north. It's brutally cold. It's tons of snow. They're basically Canada. And they became the epicenter of the abuse response, especially with domestic violence. And they're the ones who, their model is the go-to. So every state recognizes it. Something like 17 countries recognize it. If you go to the United Nations website and search domestic abuse, at least last time I did it, it's like un.org, whatever. Coronavirus, interesting. English, domestic abuse, and there's the Duluth model. All right, so this little, it's like 80,000 people, northern Minnesota, is internationally recognized as the model for how we think about abuse. And so we'll talk about that story, how that happened, but also talk about critical theory and how that is what drove the framework of the Duluth model. And then the power and control wheel, that's there. You may have seen it, and I'll print it for you when we get to that point. That's their model of a circle of power and control. Or I'm sorry, the center is power and control. That's the core of abuse. The circle is violence. And then they do different pie wedges that describe all the different ways. And where that came from is interviewing women who were abused by their, I don't know how many were husbands and how many were boyfriends, but there's some very helpful things in it. But the whole framework is defined by critical theory. And so because power and control are the problem, the solution is equality within a circle of nonviolence. Right? That's the prevailing model. So we'll talk about that. Week four, we're going to do a biblical definition. And so and I'd love to discuss this. I tried to come up with a definition that would be succinct, so it'd be memorable, potentially useful, broadly applicable. Right? So I had five main words: selfish, compulsion, to the pronounced detriment of another. And by compulsion, I mean to compel someone, right? To override their agency to some extent. So selfish, that's motive. Compulsion, that's means. Pronounced, so it's not minor, it's pronounced. It could be a one-time thing like murder, like rape, like, okay? That's pronounced. Or it could be something that cumulatively is pronounced, right? Every day, a kid comes home and his mom just berates him. Every day. It's looking for what he did wrong, right? Cumulatively, that gets to be pretty pronounced. Okay, so selfish compulsion to the pronounced detriment. So it's harm. It's harm as God defines it. So not as we, not as our feelings define it. Not that those things are necessarily at odds, right? Our feelings can be part of us understanding reality. But it's also, you know, if you've ever told a child something that they don't want to hear, right? And they feel like you've harmed them profoundly, but you haven't, right? They don't get to define detriment. God gets to define, was that detriment or was that love? Okay, so detriment and then another. So that's my succinct biblical definition. And then, so the selfishness wheel is how I'm describing abuse. And the loving leadership wheel is what I'm saying is the, and I just used wheels because that's what everybody uses. And so thought it'd be helpful. So we'll talk about that, Lord willing. And then week 5, we're going to talk about justice. We'll look to define justice biblically and look at the components of justice. And there's lots of interesting things. So as I was looking at, okay, what do you do with, you know, a woman who comes and says, look, my husband is beating me. But she has no proof. Right? You have no way to verify that. Is it, well, you know, come back when you have bruises? Like, that doesn't seem right or helpful. So how do we think about, how do we think about responding? Does the Bible have anything to say about he said, she said, where there's little to no evidence? Does it have any structures for dealing with, right, things like that? And spoiler is, it does, right? So we'll get into that. So that's justice. And then week 6, maybe we'll do wrap-up Q&A. We'll see where we're at. I do want to make sure we'll talk about a duty of protection and a duty of resistance. That is a potentially controversial one, that we have a duty before God to resist abuse. It's wrong to cooperate with abuse, including governmental tyranny. I could not find, I'm just giving you teasers, I don't want to get into them. I could not find any story in Scripture that positively presents cooperation with abuse. Every story presents resistance. And people who resist are commended. And, of course, one of the great ones is Abigail. But there's lots and lots and lots of others. So we'll talk about that. So it's not just you can resist. It's actually you must resist. Now, obviously, there are people who are unable or less able to resist, right? A child who doesn't have the strength and ability to get out of an abusive home, right? Or a mom who is, she or her children are being abused, and so she has to be very wise in how she thinks about getting out of that situation so she doesn't expose her children, who she has a duty of protection to, doesn't expose them to abuse, right? So I'm not in any way saying, hey, these things are easy. I'm just saying, here's biblical principle, and then how do we apply them? That's where there's need for wisdom and thought and engagement. So that's the overview of what I'm hoping to cover. Okay, and just so you know, I'm aiming to be done by 8:30, and I'm just going to go, and if you need to use the bathroom or get coffee or whatever, please do. Seems like when I take a break, it almost always gets to like 20 minutes because just you all like to talk. That's good, right? But it's hard to come back, so we're just going to go. So let's talk about definition and the prevailing model. And I'm not going to get into it as much as I will next week, but I did want to. I just put a few definitions here. This is straight out of the dissertation. A few representative definitions. These are all from Christians. So the first one's Darby Strickland. She's at CCEF. Chris Moles is very well known. He works especially with men who abuse, domestic abusers, and the Holcombs. And Brad Hambrick, who's well known. So you can see Strickland, that's a long one. But abuse occurs in a marriage when one spouse pursues their own self-interest by seeking to control and dominate. And I want you to look for those words and synonyms. Control and dominate the other through a pattern of coercive, controlling, and punishing behaviors. I like to use the term oppression, since it provides a framework for this behavior. It's addressed in Scripture, captures the domination that it involves. No matter what the oppression, what form the oppression takes, its intended outcome is the same: to punish and wound a victim so that an oppressor gets their world the way they want it. An oppressor's behavior says, serve me or suffer the consequences. Right? So you see, and I call out there, control, dominate, coercive, controlling, oppression, domination, and an ultimatum. Right? That's all power and control language. She does also get at the, without labeling it, she does get at the element of selfishness, which I appreciate, right? Serve me or suffer the consequences, getting the world the way they want it, that sort of thing. So Chris Moles, much more succinct, the heart of the matter is pride that seeks to control. In certain ways, that's closer to my definition. So pride, selfishness, seeks to control. But then he kind of drops the pride thing. Abusive men desire control above everything else, right? They attempt to dominate and control their partner and the circumstances, enlisting support from any means possible. I cannot overstate this point enough. Abusive men want to control and will go to extraordinary lengths to gain and maintain control over their partners. So you see that emphasis on control, right? It's all about control. That's what they want more than anything. And I'm saying, there's truth to that, but I don't think that actually, there's two problems with that. It says, it implicitly says there's no such thing as good control, but it also makes it the central motive, which I think confuses it biblically. I think selfishness is a better understanding of the motive. But my concern is more the implication that there's no good control. Right? Control is actually a good thing. Which we'll talk about next week. And then the whole comes, so in domestic violence, a pattern of coercive, controlling, or abusive behavior that's used by one individual to gain or maintain power and control over another individual in the context of an intimate relationship, to gain or maintain power and control. Right? So, and then Hambrick, the very heart of abuse is centered in the love and misuse of power. So power and control. You'll see those, and those are just a few. I have a bunch more in the dissertation. Almost all of them use that terminology of power and control. And, you know, part of what got me thinking about it is thinking about, when Matt arrests a criminal, he's exerting power and control against their will, right? And it's righteous and good. And is actually loving that person and pursuing their good. Right? There's a right use of power and control. So if power and control are the issue, and yet there's ways that it can be used rightly, then maybe power and control aren't quite the issue. Right? Now, power and control and a person selfishly using those things, that is the heart of abuse. Right? And it's wicked. And it's oppressive. And it's everywhere. But what are we calling a person away from, and what are we calling them to, when we're confronting the abuser? Are we saying give up your power and control, or are we saying, how do you actually, if assuming you're in a relationship where you should have power and control in some capacity, how do you use those things righteously for the good of those God has entrusted to you? Right. So. We'll get into those things. But that's just, I wanted to give you those few brief definitions just to kind of raise the issue of power and control. You'll see that all over the place. Abuse through the ages. I wanted to include a historical element in large part because I find church history so helpful. You understand there really are almost no unprecedented times. Like, we live in precedented times. Like, all this has happened before, right? And the church has been through it before. And the church has responded, and the church has thought about it, right? And so we do well to understand how the church has thought about and responded to these issues so that we don't try and reinvent the wheel. So I did a little, and I won't get into all this, but you can see, this is from the Oxford English Dictionary. So abuse comes through the French, which comes through the Latin, with that idea of improper use, right? So the prefix ab, which means off or away or from, and then use, you know, employ for a purpose. So it's employing something for contrary to its intended purpose. To abuse is to misuse, right? It's to use in a way that it was not designed for. And so you see, I got a few examples here from English literature throughout history. So the 1611 King James in Judges 19, the men would not hearken to him, so the man took his concubine and brought her forth unto them, and they knew her and abused her all the night. That's talking about her rape and beating, right? The Levite's concubine. It's basically the darkest moment in Israel's history. They're worse than the Canaanites that they displaced, right? There was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes, right? These wicked, wicked, wicked men. So Othello, I am no strumpet. That's a word that should come back. But of life as honest as you that thus abuse me, right? You ill use me, you mistreat me. Part of what I'm looking to do is to expand our thinking a little bit. So abuse, oppression, tyranny, right? These are all synonymous terms. They're getting at the same dynamic. And so oppression has been used. Oppression in most Bibles, oppression is used much more, most English Bibles, is used much more than abuse. The only exception to that is the Message. The Message uses abuse much more and oppression much less, which makes sense. It's aiming for a younger readership, right? It's trying to be more easily understood. But oppression is a word you'll see in Scripture quite a bit. And so Chaucer used it, the horrible deed of her oppression. He was talking about rape. So that idea of being selfishly compelled against her will. So that's just some of the kind of historical developments of English through the ages. In my dissertation, I have about 25 pages where I go through different historical discussions and incidents of abuse. It's very interesting. The idea of kind of this personal journal was not really a thing until much later in history. Like Augustine kind of started the idea of writing about yourself as a from the interior world, but most of ancient writing is not that way. And then even just to have access to the materials to write and record what went on in your life was not really possible, or to have the ability to write, you know. So most of what's recorded in the early church are things concerning the church's engagement with the government and then like church councils, those sorts of things. And so you start with Justin Martyr in the 100s, and he's writing to the emperor to request that they stop oppressing Christians, right? And you see him talking about justice in that context. And then I have different councils dealing with things like accusations against elders and who could be a witness. If you're younger than 14, you can't be a witness. If you're facing charges yourself, you can't be a witness until you're cleared of those charges. They have things like if a bishop knows that someone has done something wrong, but they can't prove it. They don't have proof. Say they saw somebody do something wrong, but they don't. All they have is their own testimony, right? I saw him do it. He can't execute a penalty against that person, excommunicate them, whatever, without some additional proof. You need to meet the biblical standard of two or three witnesses, and that the bishop should not be insulted by that reality. They talk about that, right? And so you can get the dissertation if you're interested and look at some of these stories that deal with various things. One of the things that was interesting, Augustine talked about a situation where a man was bringing charges against another man, and they were both pursuing, I think, to be bishops. And the man bringing charges Augustine knew him and knew his character and didn't trust him. And so he was acting justly, but he wasn't doing what the man wanted him to do, right? And so the man became very angry and started making demands of Augustine, right? And revealed his character for the world to see when he didn't get what he wanted. And that is actually one of the principles of justice, is as the wheels of justice grind, the character of the parties involved is often revealed, right? Because it's not unusual for somebody to be like, forget this, right? I got to have evidence. I got to be willing to be cross-examined. How could that be? You don't understand. I'm a victim, right? And their character comes out. And you see who's really fearing the Lord and who's kind of got their own agenda. So Augustine has a really interesting example of that. Luther is more where you start to get the kind of interpersonal stuff. I love Luther. There's a great I included an anecdote here that doesn't have anything to do with abuse, but he talks about Adam and Eve must have scolded each other roundly during their 900 years together. And consider that, 900 years. Right? Eve would have said, "You ate the apple." And Adam would have replied, "But why did you give it to me?" There's no doubt that during their long life, they encountered numerous evils as they sighed over their fall. It must have been an extraordinary regime. And so Genesis is a remarkable book of wisdom and reason. Right? I think it's funny. So Luther... He's the spark of the Reformation, right? He's in Wittenberg, and people are coming to him for training. And he's writing, like, it's insane the amount of writing that Luther did. Insane. Even with, you know, employing people to actually write, like, just crazy amount, the output of this man. Luther, his works are like 50-some volumes, like thick, right? This is no computers, right? Handwritten. And so people were consulting him for issues. And so people would write him with, it's like, ask Pastor John, okay? Ask Pastor Martin. That's what it was. And so someone writes him a letter for a woman who's been deserted by her husband. And here's his response. "If the situation is such as you report, namely that the widow's husband deserted her 7 years ago and no one knows where he is, you should first ask the neighbors or the village magistrates. If they have any knowledge of the matter, which of the two is the guilty party? If, according to the testimony of neighbors, it appears that the woman is not to blame, let the pastor in Eisenberg," that's the village, "post a public notice on the church door and do the same in your village, citing the man or somebody else on his behalf to appear within 4 weeks. If he does not appear, announce from the pulpit that the deserter has not yet appeared and that the woman is therefore free to marry again. Thereupon you may unite her in marriage with another man in God's name." So, okay, she's been deserted, apparently. And he's like, here's a process. Okay. And I just note, so what are the principles of justice? Well, he acknowledges this is a single-party accusation. I'm hearing that this man abandoned this woman. But he doesn't know. Right? So he says, if the situation is such as you report. So assuming what you're saying is true. Okay. But then... So he says, okay, well, this needs to be corroborated. Then he says due process. So let's have public action, right? Let's ask neighbors. Let's ask the magistrates, the authorities to testify. Then there's a presumption of innocence. So even though the man appears to have been gone for years, there's no assignment of guilt. We need the corroboration first before we say he's guilty, right? Then is the role of witnesses. So if the neighbors can testify that she's blameless, then... And we'll see that with things like the cities of refuge, right? Where it wasn't, the cities of refuge, well, we'll get into it. And then a final step is given. Okay, here's your chance. This is your last chance. If this man or his representatives can come and say, nope, here's what went on, then, but if all that doesn't happen, then that, we've honored the Lord, we've honored everybody involved, and now we can say, okay, you're released from that marriage and you can marry again in the Lord. It's a just process. In a broken world, caring for a woman who had gone through a serious hardship. It's not, hey, yep, no problem, yep, good, you're gone. Sorry, Terry, I didn't scare you.
I saw you jump. But that's him thinking biblically, right? Applying biblical truth.
There's other situations too. He talks about the nature of how a prince should exercise his authority for the good of the people the Lord has. He calls him, there's a German phrase, a Zeltsumwildpret, a rare animal, right? The God-fearing prince is a rare animal. But he talks about how he can rule over others for their good. Actually, it's really one of the interesting things about the Reformers. They had a very high view of the Christian magistrate. They said that these guys represent God in a special way because God is the supreme authority. And so if you have civil authority and you rule righteously, you're honoring the Lord in a profound way, right? Which is not how I don't think we tend to think about politics, but I think it's actually a better view of it. Right, that they can be a wonderful God-honoring role. And then there's a few, Luther's table talks, you know, he would sit around at his dinner table and the students and others, and they would just talk about all kinds of things. And then after he died, the students would record it. And so the challenge is he never got to review these and say, yes, that's what I said, or that's right. But there were a few stories that could potentially classify as abuse. So he talked about, for the sake of a mere nut, his mother beat him until the blood flowed. Right? So he talked about her strict discipline. He said, they meant it heartily well, but I was made timid by it. And he talks about how he wouldn't like to beat his little Hans very much because he wouldn't want him to be afraid of him. But he also talked about at school, he was beaten, I think he said, 15 times before lunch because he couldn't decline and conjugate his verbs. And he's like, they never taught me how to do that. And then they're beating me for it, you know. So he might have suffered some significant mistreatment. There's some stories from Calvin's Geneva. There's a great book called Calvin's Company of Pastors. And it goes through what pastoral ministry was like in Geneva. And so, you know, part of what's really foreign to us is this established church. And so in Geneva, they had embraced the Reformation. They brought Calvin in. Farrell, this guy named Guillaume Farrell, who was this fiery, red-headed, left-handed prophet guy, he threatens Calvin, right, that he has to stay and be a pastor. And so Calvin pastors. Doesn't go great. So they both leave, like the city drives them out. After they leave, it goes worse. And so the city begs him to come back. And he comes back, and then he finishes his life there. And so the city is the hub, but then the surrounding countryside too. Everyone born in that region was baptized as a baby and a member of the church and a member of the city-state. Right? It was all intermingled. Which means the pastors had responsible for everyone, and it was this parish system. It was basically geographical. And so, and you read this account of the pastoral care, and you just realize, like, nothing's changed. Like, we're all still the same. Like, people are people, right? There's a little bit of difference, but there's, you know, the old hunter who comes into church with his gun and leans it up on the pew and falls asleep, right? And there's the young woman who, the rich noble comes to church and she goes up to him and tells him that the Lord told her they're supposed to get married, right? And there's just all these stories. There's really the guy who brings his dog in and the dog snoring. And, it's just people are people. But they're also dealing with things of pastoral care. And they're dealing with mothers who refuse to feed their children, right? Fathers who refuse to provide for their families, men who beat their wives. They're dealing with landlords who extort their tenants. They're right, and these pastors, they're cooperating with the city council, so they have ecclesial authority. They don't execute the civil punishment. So, you know, the church has the keys, right? Excommunication. The government has the sword, up to and including death. So scourging, and then eventually death.
and you see them working together to care for people in these situations. And they're confronting abusive husbands, and they're confronting abusive landlords, and they're seeking to apply biblical justice in these situations. And so there's some stories in here that I won't get into for time, but you can read. And then I have a lengthy section from William Googe, who was a Puritan, and his discussions of authority and the nature of... So he talks about the relationship between a husband and wife. And they use the old language of superior and inferior, right? And they're not talking about value before God. They're talking about station, right? Authority. That the husband's the superior and the wife's the inferior. And he talks about, does a noble wife need to submit to an average husband, be him ever so mean? Not meaning angry, but average. And yes, of course. He's her husband. She needs to respect his role, his office. And then he talks about, but there's no two betwixt which there's so little inequality, right? So he's basically saying, in the authority structures of God's world, this is the least unequal, right? And he talks about how a husband's disposition towards his wife should be inclined to agree, meaning inclined to bless, inclined to give, and he rebukes husbands who stand on the uppermost step of their authority. He says it's like a sword that is dulled through too much usage, right? It's very, very interesting, very pastoral. He's just going through Ephesians, as the Puritans do. You know, he takes like 20 verses and writes hundreds of pages. But just very interesting. He talks about parents and children. He talks about servants and masters. So he talks about masters who abuse their servants by harshness, but also masters who mistreat their servants by being overly familiar with them and not holding them to their responsibilities. And the same with parents and children, right? Parents who are like, my kids are my buddies. No, they're your kids, right? And you need to have authority and exercise that authority for their good, right? And so he talks about these dynamics, it's interesting to read these things from the history of the church. So any questions before I go into the last section here or interaction? Okay. So I want to end today with two key myths. The first is, and this is where you hear the believe all women, believe all victims. The reason given is false accusations are incredibly rare. Okay. Here's it's not whether you call it a myth or just kind of a half truth. False accusations means accusations that can be proven to be false. So there's evidence, right? So Andrew accuses me of abusing him, and I'm like, no, I was in Utah last Tuesday when you say I did that, right? Like, okay, I have, here's the boarding pass, and right? So I can demonstrate that that's false. Those do seem to be rare in the 2 to 10% range, okay? There was a study done at a major Northeastern university over 10 years that looked at, I don't remember if it was just sexual assaults, but it was on a college campus. And they found, yes, false accusations in that range. But the vast majority of accusations, about two-thirds, fall in the can't go either way range. Only about a third were actually even prosecuted because there was enough evidence to do that. Right? And so often when you hear that, well, false accusations are, 2 to 10%. And if anything, they're underreported, which is probably true, right? Acts of abuse are probably underreported. It leaves the impression that 90 to 98% of accusations are true, which is just not the case statistically. And that's where we got to think about that biblically. Okay, so yes, we can prove that 2 to 10% are false. But there's a significant 60 to 65% that we don't know, right? And so therefore, to believe all accusations on the basis of we can only prove this smaller percent is false, I think is practically unwise, not to mention unbiblical. The other thing I would say is that if anything, false accusations would be even more underreported, right? So I, you know, part of my job as a pastor is to hear false accusations all the time. Like, it's called counseling. And some of them are quite serious, and are some of the serious false accusations are just obviously false. I don't report it. Like, nobody's going to do anything about it. Biblically, if you make a false accusation against someone, what you should receive is the punishment that person would have received if the accusation were true. That's a basic principle of biblical justice. That should be a principle of our civil justice. People who make false accusations receive the penalty, right? So, Jussie Smollett, or, you know, I just heard about a teacher in Virginia who was accused. There's a woman who was accused of sexual assault against a male student. And this was like 2015, 16. 4 years later, so she's accused, mugshot, loses her job, reputation shot. 4 years later, it's demonstrated to be false, and she wins, I don't know, $4 million from the school. Well, great. But in the meantime, her life is ruined, right? And even with the proof that she didn't do it, there'll be people who'll be like, yeah, but I don't know. Right? I don't know. False accusations biblically are very serious. And part of why the Bible requires 2 to 3 witnesses is because your reputation, there are certain things that any of us could accuse anybody else of that would ruin that person's reputation for anybody who ever heard about that accusation. Because the accusation would be so heinous that even if you knew on some level it didn't happen, it'd just be like, yeah, but I don't know, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. So we have to be really careful. And even just think about how the Bible talks about gossip and slander, right? It's that juicy morsel. And the Proverbs 18 principle of the first one to present his case, it sounds right until another comes along to question. None of us are strong enough, godly enough, discerning enough to hear an accusation and not be affected by it. You are affected by it. You just are. And biblically, it's deeply problematic. And so we need to think through biblical speech ethics. So it's... And we do also need to have that category of there can be genuine abuse that we are just never going to be able to prove, where we just don't have access to evidence to meet the biblical standard to demonstrate it, right? And if you're in that place, that's a very challenging place to be. Where someone has made an accusation against you. Well, both ways. So where you've been wronged, and you know you've been wronged, and you can't prove it. And to honor the Lord and not go about gossiping and slandering and, right, charging the Lord, right, that's a very challenging place to be. It's also a challenging place to be if you've been falsely accused and you can't prove it. You can't. Or you shouldn't speak to it because of various circumstances, right, where people are out slandering you And it's like, what are you going to do? Just go around and try and figure out everywhere those people go and then follow them up and say, actually, what they said isn't true. And blah, blah, right. Like, that's not going to go over. It's a very challenging place to be. So we do need to think biblically about false accusations. We also need to think biblically about a person's reputation is an important value biblically. And we want to be slow to damage that. The Reformed confessions and catechisms do a brilliant job with the Ten Commandments talking about the positive obligations of the commandments. So the commandments forbid things, right? You shall not murder. You shall not bear false witness. By implication, they command things. So it's not just, hey, don't kill anybody. Well, that's great, right? I don't think any of us have murdered anyone. So we're good on that one, right? Well, no, but it's more than that, right? Like Jesus told us, yeah, if you've been angry in your heart, but even that's negative. The positive is seek the good of others, right? And don't bear false witness. The positive to that is seek the good reputation of others, right? Be a man or woman of integrity who stands for truth. Don't cooperate with lies. The Bible says all kinds of things about that. So that's worth our confession. The Trinity Confession doesn't get into that, but we're working on a catechism which will. And those are always helpful. But you can look at the Westminster Catechism or any of the Reformed. They'd have good discussions on that. So we need to think biblically about false accusations. The other is this issue of the church having a massive abuse problem and the world's doing better than the church as regards abuse. So, a few things on that. Augustine has this quote. He says, I've hardly found any men better than those who have done well in monasteries. So I have not found any men worse than monks who have fallen. And it's an interesting expression because he's getting at this dynamic that our modern sociologists and their research are finding, which is the least likely group to abuse are evangelical Christians. But one of the most likely groups to abuse are nominal Christians. It's really interesting. Now, and part of what's in that is America has been historically, from a sociological perspective, primarily Christian, right? Like something like 70% of Americans identify as Christians. 330-ish million, so 230 million Christians in America, supposedly. So anything that happens in America is going to be done by Christians as the majority, right? Almost certainly, because of how people identify. And you might have heard years ago they would talk about, the divorce rate is the same in the churches and in the world. But if you go look at those statistics and you just control for certain things like going to church once a month, let alone weekly, right? Reading your Bible with any sort of regularity, just things that would be kind of basic indicators of basic Christian discipleship. When you control for that and separate, those people, their divorce rate is significantly lower than the world, right? And it's the same thing with abuse. So evangelical Christian men are the least likely group to abuse. Does it mean there's no abuse in the church? Absolutely not. There is, right? There is. But it's not. One of the things that was most distressing to me in reading these abuse books is how all of them, I don't recall reading one that didn't, just disparage the church. The church has done a terrible job at this. They don't know how to do this. There was one statement where they said, historically, the church has done much better at dealing with sin than suffering. Suffering than sin. No. Sin than suffering. Yes, sin than suffering. So saying the church has addressed sin, but has not addressed suffering, meaning they don't care for the abuse. And I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. Who has built the hospitals? Who's built the orphanages? Who cared for the sick and the plague? That's the most historically ignorant thing I've read in a long time. And so there's all these accounts that are just disparaging. The church is so bad at this, and they don't care, and they're all about power, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, look, yeah, every church I know is full of sinners, right? Like those are the only churches that are out there. They all have problems, and no church has handled any issue perfectly throughout its history, right? But my experience of the church is people caring for those who are suffering, caring for those who've been victimized, coming alongside people in their distress, confronting sin, you know, rebuking the unrepentant, calling people to righteousness. Like there's no group in our society doing better than the church at those things. And so that's part of what I want to push back on, is like this just, oh, the church is so terrible. And it's just like, no, I don't think that's accurate. I don't think it's fair. And I think that's actually part of the plan and part of the program. So, you know, one of the things, I'll give you a specific here in a second, but one of the things to recognize is there's been a concerted effort to destroy the influence of the church in society, because the church is seen as the lasting great impediment to progress. And that goes all the way back to Marx. He said the critique of religion is the most basic critique. That's where we start, right? Because if we can break that stranglehold, then we can accomplish our agenda. And so in America, the group that's most targeted right now are the Southern Baptists, because they're the only real Protestant group that has any significant cultural influence, right? So the Southern Baptist Church is like 45-ish thousand. So there's something like 400,000 churches in America, roughly. 45,000 of those are Southern Baptist. So 1 out of 9 churches in America is Southern Baptist. That's impressive, okay? They have something like 15 million members. Now, it's probably lower than that because they notoriously inflate their numbers, but millions and millions and millions of members. They are a statistically significant group. They give hundreds of millions of dollars every year to seminaries and relief and missions and church planting, and hundreds of millions. Okay, hugely influential group, and target number one for the progressives in our society. If you follow Megan Basham at all, she just did an article talking about how, so Russell Moore, who used to be a Southern Baptist and is now, I don't even know if he's a Christian, he attacked the Southern Baptists and then bailed on them. There's a group, him and David French, who's same place, and then a guy named Raymond Chang. And they took money from these progressive groups to establish this curriculum called the After Party, which again is, you know, you need to move on from these conservative politics. And they're trying to call the church to progressivism, basically. And there's all kinds of money and all kinds of influence being used to try and move the Southern Baptists away from biblical orthodoxy. Because if they can sweep them away, that's the last obvious Protestant bastion in America. Okay? So I think I have it here. I don't remember what year it was. So the Houston Chronicle did a report on abuse in the Southern Baptist Convention. You might remember this. Something like 700 cases of abuse over 21 years, right? And I want to be really clear, like, there's no case that's, like, it's all heinous, right? I don't in any way want to minimize, like, where there's genuine abuse, it's heinous, it's wicked, it must be opposed. I want to put it in perspective, okay? So 21 cases, or sorry, 700 cases over 21 years, so 35-ish cases a year, for a 15 million member denomination with 45,000 churches, okay? The Department of Education puts out a report every year, and they have, I think it's 95,000 schools, 99,000 public schools, so about twice as many public schools as Southern Baptist Church, okay, twice as many, and 55 million, roughly, enrolled. I think that's actually lower. After COVID, it keeps going down. Okay, but So about three times as many, 3 to 3.5 times as many people, twice as many churches. Okay, Southern Baptists average about 35 cases a year with this study. The Department of Education records 15,000 cases annually in public schools. 15,000 versus 35. Nobody's doing an expose on that. That's not in the Houston Chronicle, right? It's way more dangerous for your kid to go to public school than the Southern Baptist Church. Way more dangerous. Not even close. And that's I'm almost certain, and I'll double check, I'm almost certain that's staff, teachers, janitors, coaches, and on students. Not student on student. Right? So that, you know, there was a stat a few years ago being used that 1 in 4 women who went to college was sexually assaulted. When I heard that stat, I'm like, that can't be true. If that's true, every father in America is a moron. Like, what are you doing? Sending your daughter to a place where she stands a 25% chance of being sexually assaulted. Like, you got to be kidding me. And it wasn't true. There was a political agenda there, but it was 1 in 40, which is still heinous, right? So college women have a 1 in 40 chance of being sexually assaulted, right? Now, these are significant evils in our world, and it's only going to get worse and worse and worse. And what they're trying to say is the church, right? The church is the problem. And the church hasn't taken. And the church is all about power. And the church is, it's like, no. The church, you know, obviously, there's churches that have totally messed it up, right? And need to repent and need to take responsibility. But to say the church is not accurate, right? By and large, the church is doing a million times better than society. Not that we can't grow, not that we can't improve, right? But it's not. So just those two categories I wanted to give you. One other thing I'll mention. So I mentioned, you know, evangelical men are the least likely to abuse. There's a National Family Sciences Survey, I forget. NFSS is what it's called. You can go look it up. Brad Wilcox has been doing great research for years on the state of the family. Biological parents married, living together, least likely to have children abused. Okay? Woman with cohabiting man, among the most likely. Homosexual men, among the most likely. Lesbian women, among the most likely to have a child be sexually abused. Lesbian women is actually the highest. It's apparently a very well-known fact that lesbian relationships are the most violent. Something like 50%. Right? Women's prisons, notoriously violent. So these things matter. Right? It's not stereotyping to say, hey, there's certain categories of things that are more likely to lead to abuse. There's certain behaviors that are more likely to lead to abuse. And there's certain categories, unsurprisingly, that are the least likely to abuse, which is the design that God gave for how the world should be. Can abuse happen in those situations? Absolutely, right? But it's the least likely. And so we just want to appreciate that. We don't want to be naive and act like, well, that could never happen. Of course it can happen. It does happen. It has happened. And where it happens, it's heinous. And the Lord has grace and comfort for those who've suffered that. But in this broader issue, I wanted to make sure you were aware of those. Near the end of the dissertation is more when I get into some of those studies, if you want to. Nancy Piercy just wrote a book, The Toxic War on Masculinity. She gets into a lot of the studies. It's not a great book. She thinks she's complementarian. She's actually egalitarian, but she does a good job of trying to address how her society is disparaging men. And she brings the receipts on the actual surveys and studies on these things. So, all right, any questions? I don't want to go too late. All right, let's pray and we'll get you out of here.